page after the presentation. I remind you again that we will then deal with the Council on Higher Education, same presentation, the strat plan and the annual performance plan that they will be presenting to us, and we will again after the presentation engage. Unless there's anything else, honourable members, I wish to invite NASFAS to do their presentation, and they can tell us who is here. Shall we proceed?
We did. Good afternoon, Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, honourable members. I represent NSFAS. My name is Stephen Zwane. I'm the executive officer of the organisation. I'd like to tender a sincere apology from the chairman of NSFAS, who unfortunately couldn't join us today for this discussion. I think we're quite honoured that by virtue of the agenda, a member of the NSFAS board and the Professor Musia is in the room. I think that gives us a bit of cover from a representation from the board point of view. But with me, I'm with the General Manager for Financial Administration at NSFAS, who will be talking through the detail. His name is Morgan Hiwatiwa, and also the Senior Manager for Planning and Reporting, Mr. Simpiwe Ngumalo. There is on the other side. We did circulate the presentation on Monday, timely, but our people who are bringing the presentation are also on, they were signing in at the time when we started. So we'll take you through the electronic version of the presentation, and then we'll circulate those when they do come in. Apologies for that. The presentation itself is on the screen on the next slide, outlines the flow. Firstly, we'll just remind members of the mandate, the vision and the mission, and just talk briefly about the situational analysis, the strategic focus for 2017 to 2020, and some details around the annual performance plan of 2018-2019, and then talk about the budget allocation before we move on to the questions. On the next slide, which is slide one on the screen, that talks to the NSFAS mandate. I think just to remind everybody that at the time of writing the document, at the time of compiling all the information, and as described in what the mandate of the organization is about providing loans and bursaries to eligible students, I think everybody in the room will be mindful that going into 2018-2019, that is no longer the core mandate of the institution, but we wanted to just able to, that the mandate now is about providing bursaries to eligible students, or more from students from poor families and the working class. Also, developing a criteria and conditions for granting of loans and bursaries to eligible students in consultation with the Minister of Higher Education and Training. The other part is about raising funds again, that's also one of the, I'm now going to mirror this with some of the situational analysis we faced in with. It was a big need before to raise funds. The big question is, how big an agenda is that going to be going forward? Those are some of the strategic questions we're referring to. Another one is around the recoveries of loans. Another big challenge for us as NSFAS since the pronouncement of fee-free education, what has happened is that we're not getting as much recoveries as we thought we would, and the momentum has been lost because a lot more South Africans believe if there's free education, why should we be paying? But again, it's still within the part of our mandate as an organization. Maintaining and analyzing a database and undertaking research for better utilization of financial resources, I suppose the biggest opportunity for us going forward is going to center around the how do we better implement the bursary scheme, and that's one of going to be the key, and also reflecting on the benefits of bursaries and loans over the last 26 years. Another one is advising the Minister on matters relating to student financial aid, undertaking other functions assigned to us by the Act as well as by the Minister. I think the biggest one that has been assigned for us is to administer bursaries as opposed to loans. That's really what the key mandate of the organization is. So, I'll try to read the slides that on the screen based on the, our assumption is that it's based on the projector that is closed off. I'll just read it out so that everybody gets to understand around the vision of NSFAS. It's to transform NSFAS into an efficient and effective provider of financial aid to students from poor and working class families in a sustainable manner that promotes access to and success in higher and further education and training in pursuit of South Africa's national and human resource development goals. NSFAS, in terms of the mission, NSFAS is a model public entity that provides financial aid to all eligible public university and technical and vocational education and training college students from poor and working class families. I'm now moving on to the next slide, slide number 3. That talks to the situational analysis. I think some context around the situation going into the new financial year has been provided earlier on now no longer providing a combination of bursaries and loans, but now providing bursaries to South African students who are coming from poor and the working class families. The other big piece is that policy change or that policy change in direction has got a massive implication in our ability to execute in line with the previous processes and systems. So there's a need for a change in our target operating model, there's a need to change in our processes and systems, and also there's a need to change in terms of the workforce or the number of people that are in our institution, as well as supporting the students slightly different. I'm also now talking to the significant increase in funding for both TVET and universities. Again, we said it impacts on recoveries and fundraising efforts. I'm on bullet point number 6, where I'm talking about the significant increase in funding for both TVETs and universities. We talk about that on two fronts. One, there's a lot more money that we need to disperse, but I think one of the biggest things is that there aren't enough resources to execute against this big amount of money, and the other one is the fact that the South African public start believing that education should have already been free and therefore we won't pay you whatever you need. Also, I've mentioned the fact that the pronouncement has also had a significant impact on our systems and processes, people funding model, as well as the operations of NSFAS. Because of the time frame by which we needed to produce this document and make it available, we are of the view as NSFAS that we did not do or are not in a position to properly articulate the impact right to the detail of the free education pronouncement on our key operations. To that effect, the board has supported us to look at our operating model in a lot more detail. And in the same way that 2017-2018 has been, everything looks like it will remain a moving target as the organization moves forward. I'm moving on to the next slide, slide number 4. I'm talking about some of the impact indicators. One of them is improved system of collecting funds from those funds through NSFAS. And then some of the baseline for 2017 academic year was 512 million. And also aspect of that is an integrated plan has been developed for improving collection. I use this statement of improving collection, undertaking that there has been already a challenge in that space. For 2018 academic year, 25% on growth on the 2017-2018, at the moment the auditing process is underway, which translates into a target of 640 million for 2018 and 2019. The next indicator is around number of eligible TVET college students obtaining financial aid. The baseline for 2017, 230,469 eligible students obtaining financial assistance annually, and going to 2018, eligible students obtaining financial assistance annually is about 293,925. Number of eligible university students obtaining financial aid, 230,068 for universities as well as in 2017, as well as 290,184 in the 2018 financial year. I'm moving on to the next slide, slide number 5, that talks to the 2018-2019 annual financial plan, improved alignment between business model and the APP. For the most part, we always had an APP that was mostly divorced from the daily operations of the organization. I think from our part, we just wanted to articulate that we are striving for that going to this financial year. And therefore, we want to talk to some of the additions and some of the subtractions that we've made into our APP. One of them is improve the efficiency of the application, evaluation and funding of students, improve service level to customers and stakeholders through monitoring customer satisfaction, and taking corrective action where necessary. I think this is one of those that whenever we come into the committee, we always here just how ineffective our customer service and customer experience has been, and then we want to try and improve that and be deliberate in our approach in the coming year. In terms of the deletions, the percentage of students migrated into student-centered model is a big piece of what we have removed. And one of the contentious points that we referred to earlier on is there's a big question around that says, where we write moving into the student-centered model, isn't it time to review that? And I think there's a big discussion that is happening between ourselves and the department, but at the moment, we probably will come up with a different approach. However, we still need to improve our efficiencies from a process point of view as well as from a system point of view. In terms of the KPIs themselves that we have added, KPIs for strategic objective number 3, application evaluation, and also the service level to customers, which is objective number 5. Another addition is KPI 4.3 and KPI 4.4, existing strategic objective payments to institutions, and some minor amendments to existing KPIs have also been made. Some of the ones that we have removed, again, in line with the challenge coming informed by the Free Education pronouncement, is that we had a KPI 1.2, which was talking about funding raised from current funders. We have communicated to current funders that the NSFAS bursary scheme or the DED bursary scheme has become much more attractive than some of the CETA funding, and therefore there might be a challenge to ask them to give us a lot more money going forward. And I think the board was of the view that we don't need to be including this KPI. And then the other point that was very important here is KPI 4.3 that we have removed. Percentage of claims paid to institutions outside the student-centered model. Since all institutions are fully integrated into the student-centered model, it is our view that any NSFAS funded student will be benefiting directly from the student-centered model. Therefore, there wouldn't be a need to be paying any student outside the student-centered model in the financial year 2018-2019. Now moving on to slide number 7, just to detail some of the key goal statements and the strategic objectives. Goal number one is to implement effective and efficient processes and operations to ensure stakeholder objectives are achieved. These stakeholders in this instance will refer to the objectives of the students, the objective of the institutions, as well as all other role players involved. Goal number two, to increase access to funding for eligible students by raising funds, maximizing loan recoveries and creating a student-centered loan and bursaries model through improved communication support for students on a central application process. And then in terms of goal number one, some of the key objectives we put ourselves is improve and maintain financial performance management, IT governance, and audit outcomes. Number two, strive for an improved organizational culture of high performance and high productivity by improving employee engagement. In terms of goal number two, some of the strategic objectives we've got, increase in funding raised for financial aid for qualifying students. I want to make a distinction between the removal of the other one where we said using current funders. What this one refers to is probably other funders outside of the current model that may provide a competitive bursary scheme as opposed to the ones we referred to earlier. Objective number two, increase the amount of money recovered from NSFAS debtors. We still would like to raise, to recover the funds. I think it's too large an amount to write off. That's where we are at the moment. However, the policy pronouncement said that needs to be looked at in 2018, 2019, NSFAS forges ahead with the imperative to make sure that that money is recovered. Objective number three, improve the efficiency of the application, evaluation, and funding of students. Really, the most of the efficiency here relates to our systems and our processes, as well as effective people that are willing to work through that particular model. Improve the efficiency of payments of tuition, residence fees, allowances to NSFAS students and institutions. Very critical at the moment, as a lot of noise is coming through along this particular objective. Improve the service level of customers and stakeholders through monitoring customer satisfaction and taking corrective actions where necessary. Undertake research for better utilization of financial services. I'm moving on to the next slide, which is slide number eight. And then we're talking here about the objective, which is increase in funding raised for financial aid. In there, some of the key performance indicators, the amount of funds raised from new funders. I think the baseline is that we don't believe that we'll have enough effort to increase our, to focus on this when there's a big challenge of implementing the bursary scheme, and therefore we've kept it at 11 million, just as it was in the 2017-2018 financial year. Increase the amount of money recovered, from NSFAS debtors. The baseline for 2017-2018 was 588 million, 25% increase on the 2017-2018 actual collections. That's what we are striving for, and that's what we're looking to achieve over the next 2-3 years. Of course, subject to any changes in policy that may be critical for us to amend. Moving on to the next slide, slide number nine, MTEF stakeholder perspective. Here we talk about improved efficiency of the application, evaluation, and funding of students. The bursary provision has almost simplified for us how we're going to go about making evaluation. So we are of the view that going to 2018-2019, but more of the benefit will be seen in 2019 than 2018, is that our percentage of all applications received by 30 November, where provisional funding decisions are communicated by applicants by 31 January each year. Again, this is a model very, very fitting for universities, but very challenging for TVETs. The next one is around design and implement processes to record the date on which registration data is received from institutions. At the moment, we're not applying that, and it's not in our systems, and that's why we sometimes cannot distinguish when the information was adequately received. Percentage of first-time entry students where bursary agreements are generated within 30 days of receipt of registration data from institutions and was not applicable for this particular financial year. And I think we believe that going into the next financial year is going to be much more achievable in the sense that we would now know the how the bursary scheme is implemented and also what the bursary agreement, what the appetite is from a student point of view, given we are changing the way we are getting students to sign agreements with the organization. A percentage of returning students where the funding process is completed within 30 days of receipt of registration data, again for the last two financial years, almost going to 2018, we will only be able to start picking that up from 2019-2020. Number of institutions where NSFAS disperses allowance directly to students, currently sitting at 18, hoping to achieve a 24 of these, 50, and also ultimately all the institutions going to 2020-2021. Moving on to the next slide, number 10. Continuing with the stakeholder perspective, here we are talking about improved efficiency of payments of tuition, residence fees, allowances, NSFAS for students and institutions. Here we are talking about, from a key indicator point of view, percentage of students for which the first installment of amount due to institution is paid to the institution within 30 days from signing of the agreement. We set at 70% in the financial year that we're coming from, 2017-2018. And then 2018-2019, we are hoping for 80%, while going right along on the 90% going to the new financial year, of 2019-2020. Percentage of students for which the first installment of allowance is due to students is paid to the student within 10 days of signing of an agreement, and of acceptance of an agreement, 80%. We are looking to go into 90% and also making provision that there will always be 100% is always going to be what we're striving for. A margin of error, that's why we're keeping it at 98%. Percentage of amounts due to institutions with respect to signed agreement, accepted agreements by 13 November, which are paid to institutions by 31 December each year, we are sitting at 98%, and we are confident that we'll keep it there with a marginal error of about 2% or so. Percentage of allowances due to students in respect to signed agreement, accepted agreements, which are paid to students by 31 December each year. Again, there's a great level of comfort that we continue to keep that towards the end of the financial year. I'm moving over to slide number 11, continuing with stakeholder perspective, talking about objective number 5. Improve service level to customers and stakeholders through monitoring customer satisfaction and taking corrective action where necessary. This is a big one for us because we haven't been doing this for the last financial years. We're looking to implement that in this financial year that we're in of 2018-2019. A framework of the measurement of customer and stakeholder satisfaction will be developed in this particular financial year. And then we want to be able to then, in the next coming year, put together a benchmark for contact center performance in 5.2 and baseline the contact center performance in this particular financial year. On objective number 6, undertake research for better utilization of financial resources, a number of research reports are produced each financial year. We still aspire for 4 research reports produced. We want to assure the committee that all reports that are produced, they will always be based on what impact they can have in our operations, not just for ticking the box, and also our opportunity to advise the minister in line with the mandate that has been given to us. I'm moving over to slide number 12. In here, we are talking about the target of internal process perspective. Here, we are talking about improve and maintain financial performance management, IT governance, and ensure that we get positive audit outcomes. There are 2 major KPIs and KPI indicators here. The audit opinion of the AG is very important that you keep to clean audit. We do aspire for a clean audit in the financial year of 2017-2018, and we aspire for same going into the next financial years. And the next one is status level on the CGITAS, we want to achieve the level 3 and level 4, and also going to this financial year, we'd like to achieve level 4 continuously. And we believe that level 4 will continue to be a benchmark, and we aspire for that. Going into slide number 13, talking about learning and growth perspective, which is more the people side of things or the colleague side of things. In here, we want to strive for an improved organizational culture of high performance and high productivity by improving employee engagement. I think it is a well-known fact that every time our contact center has been called, every time we engage, our responsive rate it's always not so good, and that's a reflection that maybe we don't have the right sort of culture internal to the organization. Therefore, we want to embark on two aspects. One of them is leadership behavior of a 360-degree survey, just to also start from the top and check how our leaders are performing in relation to a peer review, and also in terms of percentage employee engagement index of 70% of employees engaged and employee engagement of 80% going into 80%. Again, is about what we do with that employment engagement survey. It's about implementing corrective measures and instituting a culture that is going to be acceptable internal to the organization. I'm moving over to slide number 14. For this part, I'd like to give it to the General Manager in Finance, who will take us through the detail around how we plan on using the budget to be able to meet all our commitments going into this financial year of 2018-2019. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, and good afternoon. I'll be taking you through the revenue. So this is the money or the funding that comes into NISFAS for the medium-term expenditure framework. The first line around the administration revenue, this is mostly the money that we receive from the department to cover our operating expenses. Our baseline is 249 million, which is set then to increase to 293 million. The organization needs to increase its capacity mainly around the people and the systems in order to cater for the additional mandate. The second line item relates to interest received of the money that we receive from the department and other funders. We do keep it in call accounts, and we earn interest on that money before that money is dispersed to institutions. Then the second category is the transfers received. The major category, as we can see from there, is the funding from the Department of Higher Education and Training, where for the 17-18 financial year, we received 12 billion due to the free education announcement. That amount is set to increase to 20 billion for 18-19 financial year. The amount is broken down between universities and TVETs. Universities moves from 9.8 billion to 14.19 billion in 18-19. The amount further increases for universities to 24 billion in 2019-20, and then 28 billion in 2020-21. TVETs, the baseline is 2.4 billion, which increases to 5.1 billion, 6.5, and then 6.7 billion in the 2021. We also have other funders that provide funding to students, but these funders are becoming relatively small compared to the additional funding that's coming from the Department of Higher Education and Training. We've got 1.6, mainly from Department of Basic Education, and then other government departments as well, contributing about 1.1 billion in the baseline. Then there are a few universities for which we administer funds on their behalf, and that amount stands at 246 billion. In terms of total funding received, it's 15 billion. Oh, sorry, 246 million. Thank you, Steve. So in terms of total funding received,
Thank you, CEO.
It's 15.3 billion in our baseline, which increases to 22 billion 18-19. And then 33 billion 2019-20, and then 38 billion 2021. We have provided some analysis just around the movement from year to year, 47.6% 18-19 to 18-19, so 17-18 to 18-19, and then 19-20 18-19 to 19-20 another 43%, then 13% increase in the last year. Moving on to the next slide, so this shows how the money that has come in is going to be utilized by NISFAS. The biggest component of our administration budget relates to compensation of employees. Our baseline is 156.7 million, which is set to increase to 181.4 million, then 197, and then 210 million in the last year. Then goods and services, mostly relating to rent and other running expenses of the business, 120 million, which increases to 103 million 108, and then 104 million in the last year. Then the transfers and subsidies, this is the money that we actually then transfer to universities. So it's the money that comes in and then we pay it to universities. I've already given the explanation for the movement in the earlier slide. And then the last two items is just some accounting entries between differences between the how we treat revenue and how we treat expenses. Thank you.
Chair, that will complete our presentation.
Thank you very much, Nessus. Honourable members, Kilian, Chairperson. Thank you very much. I just wanted to congratulate these of us on their presentation. If I recall the previous opportunity that we met with NESFAS, Honourable Chairperson, we had a bit of a very serious interaction about the quality, etc. And I think it necessary for us to recognise that and to commend them for clearly getting their sort of their structure and their systems together. So I think, and I trust that if we issue some compliments, it's not going to cause any regression. We must always strive for improvement. So please, just those comments as, by way of introduction. Secondly, I just wanted to ask your assumption, and it is a concern, obviously, about the negative impact on recoveries of the new bursary scheme. Is it an assumption that you've tested in any way, or is it just reflected in trends? Because the department this morning illustrated that student debt at institutions of learning, universities, the student debt was actually increasing over the recent, not significantly, but there's a clear trend. Now, is that your concern, and do you have the necessary contracts in place? Because clearly, and I think the communication from NSFAS and the department will have to be extremely clear that the new dispensation is phased in over a period of 5 years. This time it's for first time enrollment this year, and then I would almost like to suggest that you actually calculate your students' loan, problematic loans, to say those who have qualified and are in the employment. I don't think, we should hesitate. But the others who dropped out, do you have figures on that so that we can start guesstimating what will be the eventual impact on NSFAS? And I agree that your current focus should be on improving your systems to make this a very successful rollout rather than chasing the debt. But, let us not forget that, and let us just start looking at the nature of the student debt recoveries that you need to conduct. Second point, Chairperson, I think what is good is to see on slide 7 that they're striving for an improved organizational culture of high performance. And I just want to interrupt myself by saying you are in the fortunate position that you are expanding or growing a new an entity that was established before but that was not as big as the entity will have to be. So it is crucial, right at the inception of your growth strategy, should be the need for the development of the correct culture within the organization. And if we were harsh on you on the previous occasion, you by now, no doubt, Honorable Chairperson, the CEO, must have
found out that, you know, in the public sector financing completely different to private sector. There are so many hoops and hurdles, etc. But unfortunately, that is the only way to strengthen systems and avoid bad surprises. People exploiting the system, coming in, you know, very good interviews, in the end, they, you know, not performing. So I think what is good is that there's a very serious goal that was established to improve the efficiency of payments, because what we have understood is that there were serious alarms raised by students, but we are not always convinced that it is the mistake is NSFAS. I think on occasion students are not signing their contracts, and I think that matter must be placed on the radar, so that in fact you proactively, almost on a quarterly basis, report to institutions to say, we would love to make payment to your students that have been enrolled, but these are the problems that we are facing because politics is made of these agreements. Now, just a general question, Janet. You know, if we look at your, I like your the presentation format. The only query that I have is, if you have your objectives, you have your KPIs, and you have your baseline. Here we're saying that 2017-18 was a target. You don't have an adjusted figure for that, so that becomes a baseline. Just a question, because then we know, are you realistic, you know, building on a particular baseline for your model going forward, as far as that is concerned. For instance, slide 9, percentage of all applications received by 30 November where provisional funding decisions are communicated to applicants by 31st January each year. And the target for this current, well, the previous financial year was 70%. The question is, did you achieve it? So that we know you are way out of line. If it was 50%, then clearly 80% is not going to be achievable. So, and then I listened carefully to the research reports. I'm just concerned about what is the intention for research for better utilization of financial resources? Is it a survey? What is the nature of it? And what do you intend to take out of it? And lastly, Chair, just a comment, slide 13, I think leadership behavior 36 degree survey, it's excellent. I wish we could in fact install that sort of culture in all our public entities, that we develop leadership to accept responsibility and to remain accountable to the department and obviously to Parliament. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think I must firstly echo the sentiments shared by the former speaker in terms of the improvement that we've seen on NSFAS, and having studied the document adequately, I must commend the new chairperson, CEO rather, and also having visited the infrastructure offices lately, I see there is improvement. But I just want to just touch on 2 points. I mean, the first one is your vision mission speaks about access and success. Whilst access is important, we do not want to set people up for failure by not giving them the necessary resources that they need to ensure that they succeed. And you'd note that NSFAS particularly caters for young people who come from previously disadvantaged homes, who enter an institution of higher learning with the purpose to change the circumstances of their birth. And so they enter primarily with only one ideal and hope, which is to change their lives, and not having the necessary equipment, such as you would understand they don't have money for accommodation, they don't have allowances. And so you find that delays in those being granted in the signings of forms has negated and rather forced many young people to retract and go back home. So I just want to see, is there now a proper strategy with how we can sort of encourage institutions and students effectively to ensure that they're able to sign on time, that allowances are cleared on time, and that people are able to continue and study effectively. Because we had a situation now where I was in the University of Fort Hare last week, and we noted that some institutions have allocated individuals directly as appointed by NASFAS. You find that the institution says you submitted the list, the individual from NASFAS says that's incorrect. We are now sitting in April. They're about to write exams in the next 6 weeks, and students have no accommodation, they have no food, they have no resources whatsoever. And you'd find that most of them would go back home in June with failed academic record. So I just want to see what's the situation moving forward there. And you'd note that because so many people drop out of, who are mostly NASFAS students, it ties in with the fact that they're unable to pay back their loans effectively on time. And most of those are able to find employment, they have mediocre jobs, and they don't earn enough to be able to reimburse or give into the system. So whilst we want to ensure that we can recover funds, we don't want to trap people in the cycle of poverty. Is there then a strategic plan in how we can ensure that we are fundraising, how we give, or rather incentivize the private sector to see that education is not merely public good, but a private good as well, how we can incentivize communities that we fund as institutions and to say that let's come together to the party and give in funding so that our students are able to further their future. And lastly, there's a huge confusion, Chairperson, in terms of the free education. Particularly in our institutions of higher learning, and we've engaged some SRCs, and I want to know if you have a plan, a marketing strategy, how we go and engage SRCs, student bodies, so that they know what is the model, the time frame, so that we avoid finding ourselves in 2015 where people have said, in fact, fees have fallen, now they remember, in fact, fees have not fallen, and we find that we end up predicament again. And also I'm happy to hear that the budget has been adjusted so that there's more capacity, because your offices were collapsing and there was a shortage of staff. So the fact that you've identified that, and it also helped them, because when you have a lot of people assisting you, they're able to become nicer, changes the culture, the environment in the office, and you see that indeed what we're doing is of service to the general community. So thank you, Chair.
Honourable Duno.
Yes, Chair. Oh, thank you for the presentation. It's good. It's understandable. Yeah, it was the same as the CEO. Even last time.
Yeah, yeah. What did you say? It's good, it's good, it's nice.
Chair, my first question is around the issue of fee-free education. The former president, Honorable Jacob Zuma, announced during the pronouncement of fee-free policy that the Minister of Higher Education and Training, together with Treasury and DPME, will determine the quantum of historic debt. I just want to know what progress has been made in this regard. Secondly, what is the vacancy rate as at 18 April today, and how long have those positions been vacant, as this is important to ensure effective implementation of the fee-free education policy. In the presentation regarding finances, we see the senior manager of finance. I would like to know, where is the CFO, because there was no apology, or maybe because I was outside and I didn't get the apology. The last one, I'm just concerned, Chair, with the protests that are continuing in our institutions of higher learning. Before we closed at UKZN PMB, it was DUT, it was University of Zululand, you can mention a number of them. Those in the main are caused by delays in payments of allowances by NSFAS. We need to be really realistic about that one. Most of these protests, they are with regards to NSFAS and delays in payment of allowances. I just want to know if there is any plan on dealing with this. I can see now that if you put your mind on something, you can really do it. Even this one, just try to work on it, no more delays, because they affect the institutions negatively. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, as usual, I'm looking for certain items in the performance plan, and I'm just wondering why there is no mention of that. Or perhaps I'm missing this. One of the biggest challenges, to my mind, for NSFAS is that the position of students are changing all the time. They want to register for additional subjects, they don't like the lecturer, then they leave another subject, then they don't qualify for the exams, and they can't continue with the second semester subject, and so on. Which, to my mind, says that we need to assist you with your enormous task, a high level of IT system integration with all our institutions that you support. And have I missed it, or can you also set some targets in that regard, saying that, you know, we will have full integration with 30 of the institutions and 70 and 100% or whatever. The next one is the question in my mind that if, and may I, sorry, interrupt myself by saying some of your targets are really, seem to be very high and laudable. My question is just, even if I assist the student financially within 30 days of him or her signing that agreement, is that sufficient? What must happen in that 30 days? How must the student eat, travel, etc.? Now, I do know at this point in time you have a system of advances to the institutions, and you leave it to the institution to assist in disbursing that money then to the students, so that the more immediate need can be addressed. But again, I do not see any plans in your performance plan of how you intend to overcome that gap, if I can call it. And then lastly, we also know, and we've raised it the previous time, and you've also responded to a question to the Minister regarding the advances. You know, students have got, can I call it a relocation cost, if they go to an institution. The institutions have got certain setup costs at the beginning of the year. You know, you order the full book, you don't just order the first 10 pages for the first month, that's so to say. So there's a huge need for a cash injection early on in the year. And unless I've missed it, your performance plan is quiet on that, and it's a real problem, particularly, if I may say so, at some of our TVET colleges. And that problem has become the students' problem, in the sense that the students are not receiving their support that they need. So are there plans to address that? Can it be taken up into future annual plans, etc.? Thank you.
Honourable Kekana, and we end with Honourable Mavunda.
Can I go ahead, Chair? Okay. Chair, what I wanted to find out is, in the design of funding or financing students, do we from NSFAS have, say for TVET, short term, 3 months, 6 months, bursaries that you as a design can use to fund students who don't want to go all the long way for 3 years, who wants to do, for example, solar geyser installation, because that is needed in our communities and it will actually save as an alternative source of energy our energy supply. Also in the rural areas, do you have short-term courses, 6 months? They used to call them land boom officials, where you train guys who go out into the community and guide the community about agriculture. Basic things like soil erosion, how do you avoid that? I just think it can go a long way, and if somebody wants to come back to advance, he can do so. But just to start, they can make a livelihood out of this, say girls, just specializing in courses in TVETs of curtain manufacturing, tracksuit manufacturing for crash kindergarten kids. I mean, that is a big industry if you consider how much in the community of this are in practice. But I'm just saying for 6 months, 3 months, 8 months, do you have courses like that that you're financing? Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you, member. Percy?
Thanks, Chair. I think Comrade Danny has plagiarized my input. But, Chair, it's just a concern whether this concern is genuine or not. But it looks like the team itself constitute a sort of umuzwezinsizwa. I don't see many of women. Now, in terms of equality, I don't know what happened, but we would want to see that decorated committee for a purpose. So, but otherwise, Mr. Kekan, Honorable Kekan, covered me in most of the things which I wanted to say. Thanks, Chair.
As Honorable Kekana is smiling, it will teach you a lesson not to discuss with him your points. And he puts up his hand and then goes for it. Honorable members, those are your questions. May I ask the following? There's one. Yeah, there it is. I think you're going to know what my first question is, and if you can answer that already. I don't see in your strat plan any plans for getting out of the hellhole. Is it in here? Secondly, the presentation before lunch was from the Department of Higher Education and Training, who was able to tell us, you know, with the increase in their budget and so on, and particularly in this, they were able to give us some risk analysis. May I ask if you are able to do that? I was looking at it. And if you have it immediately, it will be good. But if you haven't done a deeper analysis, I think it will also help us so that we know and understand what is the other side that NASIS is thinking about and the board and all of you are thinking, instead of just saying, thank you very much, more money, here we go, but take the responsibility of that injection. There's a very interesting thing that you raise in your strategic framework, which I think, honorable members, in my view, there's quite a bit of value in the strategic framework that you put to us in your plan. And I think it would be very good to tell us, both in your strategic framework and what you call your situational analysis, if you can tell us, what is it that you mean when you say that you want to unpack the life cycle and then you add there within a new value chain? I take it it's the economic model of life cycle that you're referring to, or are you just using the word? If it is the first one, then I think it would be good to unpack and tell us this is exactly what you mean when you talk about unpacking the life cycle for a new value. And that means that you are thinking ahead in your in your strat plan that goes beyond the MTEF cycle, that talks about those that are still coming, and those that are in the system, and those that are exiting the system, and that you have taken into consideration the South African population, and how in, I hope, what you are attempting to tell us, it impacts then on the financing model as it relates to any future financing, and it helps towards the 2030 plan of the National Development Plan. Now, I hope I'm not ahead of myself here. I hope that's what you, because I think it's profound things that you are saying, but I think you have to walk us through to say then, what do you envisage and where do you want to take this? Where do you want to take this to? I echo the sentiments of the members, and I think some of them that spoke about the fact that you're not necessarily inculcating choices that our young people are making, and how do you weave in there the choices, the different choices that they will make that relates to lifelong learning and the different components of it. So lastly, I want to, I'm not going to say all of it. I think the strategic framework and the situational analysis is an interesting piece of reading that is in here, but don't fool us with the letters. Give us the detail of exactly what it is that you mean. I think there's a case to be made arising out of our oversight on the standoff between NSFAS and students on the one side, universities on the other side, and a lot colleges on the other side. Now, we are quite interested to find out how do we bring the different parties together in the plan that you have here, and how do you bring, for lack of a better word, in industry it's called industrial peace. I don't know what word to use, but I think you know what I mean. I'm raising this because all our oversight visits that we have, we hear, NSFAS. When we ask the question, what are you talking about? You know, we haven't filled in the forms yet. We're still going to. And all of that gives an impression to us, if we don't ask those questions, we will walk away that NSFAS has not given the money. That's why I'm asking, how do you bring sectoral peace in appreciating the difficulties that you are sitting with and who your audience is that you have to deal with? Let me make an example of CPUT. You owe them a lot of money. Why? Because they took a decision they will not fill in forms. And then they have not come to the realization that there was an introduction of free education. They still stick to their previous decision. We will not fill in forms because we are from a particular political party and this is what we say. And we stick to this, and the world is all passing them by, and then they bump into people and say they don't have food, they don't have accommodation, and so on. And we get this in most places. My question remains, what is your plan to bring a proper understanding, and where are your points that you're putting in place that strengthens the fact that you will always have students, you will always have universities, you will always have colleges, and you will have human beings in all of these things, and all of them take whatever decisions, and certainly as part of your forward planning, how do you factor that in? Now, that doesn't mean if some people work on the basis that when they go and sleep they have one idea, when they wake up that they have another idea, and you must just follow this. Obviously you've got. It then means what education do you install in there to make everyone understand there is no such a thing in life of going to sleep and then wake up and you have two different, and the country must just expect or the leadership in the country must just say, all right, this is how you feel this morning, let's just change as you change. May I ask you to answer these questions? We've got the CHE, who must also do a presentation, so can I ask you, let me see what's the time, can you be done in 15 minutes time?
Yes, Chair, we'll starve ourselves and make sure we're done by then. Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for the valuable insights you provided to us. Every question you provide, you raise, makes us think differently about our organisation. So thank you very much for that. Chair, can I start with your question around how do we bring the message of the reality we are facing as an institution to both our stakeholders and the different role players? I must tell you that we don't have an answer yet, and I think it's one of those moving targets. I think one of the reasons it remains a moving target is that we are sort of operating in project mode, Chair. We just always keep chasing what needs to be done, and we don't have enough or make enough time to go back and engage our stakeholders. So we're finding ourselves in firefighting mode all the time. I think it's something that we'll go think about. There were some thoughts that we definitely wanted to make sure we act against. One is, how do we make sure that we are present closer to the students as NSFAS, and how do we make sure that we are present in the key regions where the majority of the students are, so that they feel like they can walk across and maybe engage us. And also what the PCHET has done, which I accept and I'd really appreciate, is that every time you go and have an engagement, you insist that an NSFAS representative be there. That also helps us to align the messaging. But Chair, what I take away from that is it's something that we really need to think about thoroughly as NSFAS. And also we welcome any views and assistance in that regard in terms of how differently can we think. The other one, Chair, again, on one of your questions around the cyclical review that we are thinking about, yes, you are right. One is economic in nature, around what should the throughput be, what are some of the people we should be expecting, what are the numbers that are coming through from the different levels of our higher learning institutions, how do we then drive forward planning. But also there's another one in the middle there, Chair, that with the implementation of free education, we don't know for sure what the cost of study overall is going to be. And therefore, this year serves as a good baseline to determine how then to position ourselves differently going into the new year. So that's also one part of what we're looking at. We're looking at it on those grounds to say, what is going to be the impact on our financing model? What is going to be the impact on our operating model? Because now there are different thoughts around what should NSFAS exist for in all of those different elements. So this framework, this view is very important for us. But also the other thing about the value chain that we are looking at is that application is one part, accommodation, attending to class is another part. How do you make sure that in the value chain we shorten the lead time from one activity happening to the next? And that's one of the other part about the value chain that we are really looking to. And we'll be more than happy to share some of the key points. The getting out of the hellhole, Chair, I would like to take that and say we'll come back to you with an answer, Chair. I don't think we have an immediate answer for you in that particular regard, because I think this is the fourth time we come and face you and the same question gets raised and we think we have an answer and then we don't really have one. Second, Chair? Okay. Chair, I want to move on and thank Honourable Oosthuizen for the question around Oosthuizen, sorry. Sorry, Wes. So apologies. Apologies for that, Honourable Member.
Thank you.
The question around system integration, I would like to contextualize it in two ways. We've got a big standoff between NSFAS and the institutions as we speak, because we've asked the institution to integrate with us I suppose, one, we may not have project managed that process very well because we're not getting the joy we are looking for in the way that we want. But we also say we don't want an alternative that is going to be on spreadsheet, that is going to be risk-based, that is going to take us back to where we were in 2017. So we are where we are right now as a standoff because of integration. Where we may have lost it in terms of losing you, Honorable Westhuizen, is that we've got it under the stakeholder piece in our plan, stakeholder 3 and 4, where we talk about efficiencies in our processes, and we talk about application, we talk about onboarding, we talk about solutioning. It's the technological layer that drives us in that particular regard, but what we then will be able to do is to be deliberate about it and maybe start putting in the targets and some of the intent that you are referring to. So it's a big one, and we take that. The other one where you're referring to the overcoming of the signing of the contracts, we are busy at the moment defining a new contract that students must sign outside of the loan agreement form and the schedule of particulars, what we call the NSFAS bursary agreement. It's gone through the different loops and hoops, and we're looking to implement it in the new year. Within the next 2 months. One of the ways we're trying to achieve is how do we get students to sign electronically online, just by being able, in the same way that we say, we're going to pay you, here's a one-time PIN, how do you make it easy for that? And how do you also make it easy for them to go onto the online portal and sign there, and then we can retain the contract? So those are some of the ways we're trying, so that we remove the dependencies. One issue, however, that I just want to raise, our system is not really ready for a unified sending out of a contract. We're so used to sending out batch contracts. So we are busy trying to overcome that issue. We may have to resort to a manual signing, sending it to institutions that get them to sign until we are able to solve that one, but we are thinking differently about that. I'm mindful of my 15 minutes that I've got. I've spent 6 minutes. I'm moving on to the next one, the advanced payment of students that you referred to, Honourable Member Westhuizen, I'm going to practice this. I must tell you, in the interview process, I did say I'm going to try and make sure that we pay students in advance in the same way that you are paying institutions. Little did I know that it's much more complicated than that. But it remains an aspiration of us as an institution around driving efficiencies in that regard. I suppose the one part of relocation cost aspect has never been any language that we've used before. So I think we'll have to think slightly differently about that. I'd like to move to Honorable Kekana's question. The questions that Honorable Kekana asks us every time makes us wonder if we're really thinking expansive enough in the way we do things, very difficult questions. The question around how do we design for short causes, and how do we then design for the TVET environment so that one can just go do N4 and think that N4 is enough because it's a particular term or somebody does a short course. We don't make provision for short courses as the NSFAS. However, we are designing appropriately for TVETs. We are working with the department to deal that. I don't think we can deal that in this financial year, but we are working thoroughly on that one. So I think I do take that. Honorable Pukwa, you made reference to some of the key issues we are facing at the moment around dispersing on time, around how do we make sure that we make the lives of the students much easier. We've got that as a target, again, in stakeholder 4, objective 4 and 3. I think the chair aptly put it to say sometimes our own processes are not fully understood, and it's easy to look back and say it is NSFAS's fault, when actually when you look through the situation, it's much bigger than that. We're not telling the story well enough, so again, I take that point and we'll work on it. The Honorable Mtunu's question around the holistic debt, historic debt issue, I think part of the free education pronouncement, the department has really taken up center stage in terms of debts relating to institutions and allowed students to register and said a plan will be devised in terms of how to deal with that historic debt. I think from our side, every time we look at the word historic debt, we're referring to more the NSFAS debt, which we'll talk about on Honourable Killam's question around how we're going to deal that. So my colleague will talk to that. Vacancy rate, I think we've closed off a number of vacancies in the last 3 to 6 months. I can give you a great sense of comfort that we've had about 40 appointments in the last 4 or 5 months just to try and close that particular gap. We are also very happy that the board approved, in line with the growth path that we are on, additional headcount, and we are pushing that and also making sure that it is done within the same context. The apologies for not tendering the absence of the CFO in this meeting. The CFO had other commitments that prevented him to come and join us in this particular moment, but so apologies for that. The students' payment issues, the protests and the likes, I think the next time we come back, Chair, I'd like to just talk a lot about payments and some of the challenges that we're facing just at a high level. NSFAS pays the institutions money up front, about 30% of the annual allocation, and therefore the institutions tend to be the ones that pay the students according to the money that they do have. And sometimes an issue of registration, then we've got the ones that we pay directly as NSFAS. Our biggest challenge is that we can't pay a ghost student. So our challenge is, if I don't have a proof of registration that this student applied to 4 institutions but now is at UJ, and therefore I can pay the basis of that, I'm not at liberty to move that money. However, when I do find out that this student is at UJ and I make a payment and 40% of all the students I'm paying, their numbers have changed in the last 3 months, then for them I did not pay, but on where I sit is the student number has changed, you did have a one-time PIN to be able to transact. So it's a question of how we communicate and how we do the work. The mechanics of this thing, sometimes I think we overcomplicate it ourselves, but it's the reality of our situation. When our backs are against the wall, we can only give you the hard facts and sometimes never get the chance to be warm and fuzzy about some of these key issues. So I think I'll take that. Honourable Killam, your question around the recoveries, I'll give my colleagues to close that in the last 3 minutes that we do have. And then the baseline is also going to be covered in the... I think the point about us being on a growth trajectory is a really, really important point. I want to tell you that growth trajectory means your systems must grow because they're going to be constrained. We never prepared for these large numbers that we're currently dealing with. The number of people that are there, meaning the contact center, making sure that we are efficient, probably some of them have been around for too long to not have been able to comprehend the new reality, and therefore the rate of change inside the organization becomes stifled by people who want to reject the new change. So that's the reality we are faced up with, and I think those are the components that we're talking about. I think it's one of the risks. We've got a human resource risk. We've got a risk relating to some of the standardization project that we're going to be implementing to institutions. Institutions are more likely to reject. For example, we want to send out a standardized allowance of 5,000, and some of the institutions are so used to paying more than that, 7,500 and more, and we go back and say, now this is a new number. The revolt that is going to come with that is a big risk, and that risk is easily transferred to the student who feels it and say, oh, your NSFAS has reduced your money. And I think that narrative makes us at risk with regards to the students. So there's many components of risk, Chair. This was your point on some of the key risk factors that you referred to. I think I'll leave it at that. I think there's one on research, which I think we can be able to deal with differently. And maybe when you share, Honourable Mavunda, when we share with you the org structure, you'll be impressed that we've sort of changed the diversity that we've got in the organisation in recent months. I'd like to just close on recoveries, and then we can stop from there. Just recover is one
part. I want to give the department also a few minutes.
Okay, so just close that part. On recoveries and baseline.
Thank you, CEO. Let me start off with the baseline. So in terms of developing the APP, because of the misalignment between our current business model and where we are and the APP, there were some new key performance indicators that we needed to develop. And when we have got new performance indicators, the baseline is something that's not very straightforward. So we had to come up with an estimate. Previously, or in other APPs, you might have found that we would have used prior actuals, but also because of the constantly and the rate at which the business model is changing, we felt it was inappropriate for us to use those numbers. So we felt that the most appropriate numbers would have been the 2017-18 target, which, of course, after the finalization of the audit, would have a closer sense of what the probable baseline for the 18-19 would be. Moving on to the question that was asked on the questions or the comments on the recoveries, following the free fee education announcement, we did see some slowdown in collections, but it was mainly around the confusion around whether the NISFAS debt incurred in previous years would still be repayable. But there was frequently asked questions that was issued by the department, which clarified that issue. So from February and March, we have continued with the collections. And just one additional point on the recoveries, that the repayment terms of the NISFAS debt are quite generous. It's only repayable when we have identified that you are working with SARS, and it's a negotiated so that the debtor has to agree. So we might say you need to pay 700, but if the debtor does not agree, we'll take what the debtor is able to afford. So I think the interest of those that might not be able to afford are adequately covered in terms of our recovery strategies. Thank you.
Dr. Parker? Thank you, Honourable Chair and members. I thank you to NISFAS for a clear presentation. It was a big improvement on the last one we had, so we are also want to congratulate you on that. I just think there were a few things that we identified listening here that may need to be thought about. The one was, do you have a plan for how you'll utilize the additional 105 million in terms of the administration? I'm not sure if that was highlighted at all, but we didn't pick it up. It's a significant increase in administration to be able to manage the new processes, and we just need to understand a little bit about that. The other issue, and I think it's a very important one from the department's point of view, because we recognize this idea that you would want to pay somebody within 30 days of having signed the agreement. But one of the critical areas is the decision around getting funding, that a student gets funding, and that's linked to two things. One, that the student has registered at an institution, and secondly, that they are within the means test. Now that, for us, is the critical timeline, because if that is not decided very quickly after the student arrives at the institution and registers, then that student is at risk, because the university will have to take on the possibility that that student may or may not be funded. And that's one of the biggest difficulties about getting students some upfront funding. And it's the same with TVET colleges. If somebody, you don't know that person is going to be funded, you get an upfront amount, but how are you sure that you're not going to be stuck with the risk of having spent money on this issue? So that's one of the key things that I think we have to think about. And then maybe the last one is around the communication processes, because that's also an absolutely critical issue. It's the integration of NISFAS as an organization into the system, the PSET system. As part of an ecosystem, the communication between NISFAS and institutions and students. And not a lot is talked about in terms of communicating to students, but it's how do we ensure that we are working together with the system. And then, Chair, maybe just to inform the honourable members around the historic debt owed to institutions.
That's what we're currently doing the due diligence on, and that is linked to the agreement that we had between students and institutions and NSFAS, that students who are NSFAS qualifying would be allowed to register on signing an acknowledgement of debt form, and when they sign that acknowledgement of debt form, the entire debt is calculated. So now we are in the process of calculating how much it is by utilizing those acknowledgement of debt forms to understand what the quantum out there is, and we will work with the universities to see how we manage that process going forward. Thank you.
And the colleges, I would imagine. So I know you are the DDG of universities. Honourable members, I think we should leave it there. But I hope you would agree with me, Honourable members. We dealt with NSFAS quite a bit on the new student model. We would want you to come back and not just only deal with the new student fund model, because that one is important, because remember you still have other people that are out there that have done their own thing and they still in trouble, 14 million and all of that. They're still there. So the student fund model is still an important aspect to engage with you on the sort of quarterly basis that we did. But we want to add to that, honorable members, based on the issues that you also have raised. I don't think we can close our eyes and ears to the fact that there is trouble out there, that there is unhappiness, and the unhappiness is this one blames that one and so on. Why do we have NSFAS? Why do we have universities and colleges? Why do we have students? And so they have a bond together that is not going to go away. Now, this bond doesn't seem to be gelling together very well. And the idea that some students still did not receive any money since 2016 will remain a concern for us, despite whatever we say, whether they've signed or not. But the truth is, it is there. So we will ask you to come back, CFO and others of the department, and we would want to hear, we're done with APPs now and strat plans. Here is the plan. And we then bring the different role players together. Because what we have done is we've always brought NSFAS. We must have the student body here, we must have the USAFs here, and we must have the, what's the other one? The, for the colleges. Yes. All of them, we're going to call all of you to come to Parliament and we hear from all of you where things are at, because we can't have this thing going on and on, a silent little war carrying out there. When it gets closer to exam, they decided, let's just, now is the time. So, honourable members, I hope you would agree with me that we actually do that. We don't just focus on the student model. Is that agreed? Okay, then we will then we will do so, and we will inform you when we call you and everyone else. On that basis, may we thank NSFAS. It's a bit of an easier ride than the last time. I'm going to, you are free to stay, you're free to leave, but I'll invite the Council on Higher Education to give us their presentation. As they prepare, NSFAS, when you come with your strat plan budgets and so on, you bring your full team, because your full team must tell us these are your plans. They can't come here and one has got an apology, the CFO is not here. That we sent some CETAs in the same room. We sent them home. We will do the same with you if you decide you will only come here with some few people and so on. We don't tolerate that in Parliament. That's the next letter that you will get. CHU?
May you introduce your delegation to us? Some of the faces I recognize and know.
Thank you, Chairperson, and to honorable members. The delegation of the Council on Higher Education today is Professor Selvi Ripinga, who is a council member on my far right. And behind him is Professor Beverly Taylor, who is also a board member. And the Chief Executive Officer, Professor Bejner, and the Chief Financial Officer, Mr. Mutusi. My name is Temba Musia. I'm the Chairperson of the Board. we are going to start our presentation. Chair, I will, with the permission, with your permission, I'll go as fast as possible on the first few slides, which are, in my understanding, pretty much well known to the committee in terms of the mandate and vision and all of those things, and then focus on other areas of the strategic plan. We are a statutory body established in terms of the law, and some of the functions that are mentioned on bullet number two is to advise the minister and of course also to arrange and coordinate conferences, some of which you can't do much lately because of the constraints by resources. And quality assurance is at the core of what the Higher Education Council is doing for all programs in higher education, and of course publishing information and doing research and promoting access. We also are governed by the section of the NQF in terms of how it relates to the Higher Education Qualifications Sub-Framework as a quality council, and of course looking into developing and implementing policies that recognize prior learning, because as we know, many people have learned certain skills elsewhere, others have accumulated credits, you know, that could be used for academic purposes and eventually cognate qualifications. We look into that in terms of the Act, and of course maintaining the database for learner records across the system, and of course lastly implementing those policies. At the core of what the CHE does is ensuring the integrity and credibility of the qualifications that are offered by institutions. And from time to time you will hear noises from different higher education providers, public and private, but that's what we have to do anyway. We also ensure that the sub framework is properly maintained, and of course conducting research. We are also, as a Schedule 3A public entity governed by the PFMA, and the vision is to be a dynamic organization that is contributing to transformation, equity, and quality in the training of students and other learners. The mission, Chair, as a statutory council, is centered around quality assurance research and, of course, promoting critical discourse and monitoring the trends and of course, advising the minister where we can proactively and or if the minister wishes to be advised on something. And the values are in four bullets: social justice, quality, integrity, and accountability. And we subscribe to that in a big way. And the key stakeholders, Chairperson, in fact, the entire public is also a key stakeholder because we got all sorts of inquiries from the public, but also the public representative is this committee. It's one of our chief oversight stakeholders, the department, and all institutions of higher learning in the country. The University of South Africa, which is representing universities, then of course SAGWA, we work in partnership, and as far as the qualifications are concerned, governed by the NQF, and that oversees and manages that kind of arrangement we have. Professional bodies, all of them, we have an interest as much as they do in the work that we do, and we engage continuously, whether it's the Health Professions Council or the Engineering Council, and law and all other professions, because as you know, there are certain things in terms of the law that we can't do, that they can do, and certain things that we can do in terms of our own. For example, if you look at the Health Professions Council, you know, the Tissue Act and all of those acts that you have, National Health Act and so forth, that govern that. Science and technology also is a partner, as well as the NRF. We're involved in some projects with the NRF as we speak on the evaluation of the standard of doctorates in the country. The constitutional factors, Chair, that I could quickly go through is that we are aware that there are all kinds of pressures on institutions, and the enrollments are projected to keep increasing in a manner that the department and institutions have agreed, and of course the resources are not increasing proportionately, and Parliament is aware of all of those dynamics around that factor. And the radical changes in the world of work is yet another challenge, because employability of graduates still depends on where you studied, and institutions from time to time will say, well, we have this percentage of our graduates employed and others actually are not. So those radical changes in the world of work mean that an engagement with the employers and actually looking into new technologies and advancements and innovations in terms of how the curriculum can be reformed for students to actually be able to match well with the world of work instead of the traditional ways of and another factor has to do with the challenges faced by many students from poor and socioeconomic backgrounds who are not adequately prepared for the demands and the rigors of university studies, and who are fully proficient in the media of instructions at universities. So the CHE, these contextual arrangements are on our radar as part of the strategy, that the students from poor socioeconomic backgrounds and also from schools that have not prepared them for university education. And of course, in partnership with the department, with the resources that they distribute to institutions to actually improve teaching and learning arrangements, we are working very closely with them on that. And transformation remains a pressure to many institutions of higher learning in the country, and it is one of the contextual issues that we are facing, whether it is the curriculum transformation, whether it's demographic profiles of students and or staff. These are the pressures that we are facing as a sector. And of course, an explosion in collective sharing and generation of knowledge online. Online learning has become quite a big revolution lately, and the manner in which students want to learn is different from how it was 20 years ago, because students require computers, they require internet, and are able to research a number of things themselves instead of a teacher standing in front of them and telling things. So those dynamics are changing. And the growing pressure on the time of the academic and administrative staff who are facing an array of tasks to complete in order to comply with legislation, elements of regulation into the system require additional work hours and person power to actually meet those requirements, deadlines, and everything else that is required by various regulatory bodies, including the department. And of course, the digitization as a motive force is also creating that challenge for us and the cost associated with it. So we, as the CHE, take this into account, that technological advances have revolutionized our way of doing things in higher education. And also, we're looking at the organizational considerations that inform the strategic plan. Accreditation is required by many institutions, private higher education institutions, publics are also, the numbers are increasing quite steadily from public higher education institutions as well lately, as a result of the contextual factors that I have mentioned. And this increases pressure and or overloading on the meager resources that we have. And from time to time, we have to get into hard negotiations with the department to assist. And this is an ongoing problem. I'm sure the committee is well aware of those hardships that we're facing. And we, as have indicated in the past, are reintroducing the audits because the quality enhancement program is winding down. So together with the national reviews that we are doing, and this is on the plan, and it is part of what is required by the Act for us to do, to go through institutions and perform these audits. One of which was a special audit that we reported to the committee recently, that was Zululand. And of course, we wish to increase the number of reviews. We also get some requests from other bodies for us to partner and see how best we can be able to improve what they offer in these programs or qualifications because of the many changes that are happening in the system. And so we also, as part of the work that we do, need to bring the directories to work more closely together instead of working, you know, in their own silos. We have pretty much integrated much of it now for the management team to actually ensure that there are synergies between departments, that departments can't just go on their own, because we don't have, first of all, resources for departments to do their own thing, but they can cross-pollinate one another, save resources where we can, but still deliver what is required. And of course, we also need to introduce, as part of the strategy going forward, some of the things that we're already doing, but we just want to maintain a greater agility into the structure and functions of the CHE to respond as quickly as possible. So the responsiveness remains a problem in certain areas where there are human resources capacity and or financial resources capacity for us to do what we need to do in order to respond to the external environment. And from time to time we listen to complaints from some institutions that we are not responsive enough. But if we look at the rigor and the integrity of what we need to do and the partnerships that we need to have with other stakeholders, certain things can be done faster, but others cannot just be done just like that because they have to be researched properly. I will now request the CEO to proceed from the colorful slides, and the CFO will follow later. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. As the Chair of Council has illuminated, the high-level strategy and strategic orientation of the organization is set by Council, and these are then on an annual basis translated into the performance imperatives that we've identified. So what I'll be speaking to is how we've taken the high-level objectives set by Council and translated them into operational objectives and outcomes. So in slide 14, the colorful part, as pointed out, is the high-level strategic goals of the organization, giving expression to our various roles as a quality assurer, as a center for information, policy analysis and advice, as a quality council, then also to be an effective, sustainable and dynamic organization that serves the sector and our society more generally. So each of these is translated into a program, and then with each program we indicate what the purposes are, then what the strategic objectives are to give expression to the translate the purposes into practical outcomes, and then on the one-year basis what the actual outputs and tangible deliverables are. So that's the structure of the larger part of the presentation. So for the first program, which is institutional quality assurance, that is the main substance of the work that we do, and there are three sub-programs here. That of program accreditation, quality enhancement, and institutional audits, which is intended to be introduced from 2019. Now, their objectives, I won't go into the detail of the objectives, but they are outlined here. What is of importance for the one-year horizon is what we plan to deliver. And as far as these are concerned, on top of the list is a development and refinement of a methodology for the reintroduction of institutional audits, as we've been directed by Council. It's also our intention to, by 2020, to have completed 8 institutional audits. So we want to shorten the cycle so that the audits are done in a 5-year cycle, so that we get constant feedback at the institutional level as well as at the systemic level on the higher education sector. So we also want to improve the turnaround times for the new programs, and the numbers are growing while the resourcing remains the same. We also anticipating a huge bubble as many institutions rush now to meet the 31st of December 2019 deadline for non-aligned programs. And we've calculated that they're in the region of 3,400 non-aligned programs. And just to remind the committee that the capacity of the CHE and its accreditation process is about 600 programs per year. So if you're suddenly going to get, and we anticipate this year, anything up to 1,800 programs for this year, and possibly about 1,200 to 1,300 next year. So that's really going to put tremendous stress on the CHE systems and resources, as well as capacities. And we've been engaged with the department to help us deal with this bubble. And they've been very helpful as far as that is concerned. Also in this year, we'll be bringing the QEP process to closure, and there are 4 key things as far as that's concerned. One is that we have a synthesis of the first phase. We have a baseline report on the second phase. We'll have a code of good practice emerging from the first phase, and then the Exco of Council commissioned an evaluation of the QEP, and that's been completed. We just received the report this past week, in fact. That would conclude that particular project, Chair. And the second program is qualifications management and program review, and the Chairperson's always spoken to this, our intention to upscale the number of standards development and review processes. There are a few in the pipeline at the moment. There's one on the BCom, there's another on the emergency medical care. He mentioned the doctoral review underway, and there's one on library and information studies. And that's why we also conclude the LLB review process, because the institutions would be submitting their self-improvement plans, and we will be monitoring those going forward. Then we also, in order to give further impetus to the entrenchment of the national qualifications framework, from our perspective, working in the higher education sector, we develop relevant policies that help to strengthen the implementation of the NQF, and on an annual basis we review the policies that are already in place and then develop new policies. So, for example, in this past financial year, we've developed one on credit accumulation and transfer. And there's an ongoing pressure to promote and support articulation in the various sub-sectors in post-school education and training. So the intention for this financial year is 4 qualification standards, and then the completion of another national review, which normally takes between 24 and 36 months. The next program is that of research, monitoring, and advice. And the purpose really of this program is to advance the second strategic objective, which is making the CHE recognized Center for Information, Policy Analysis and Advice on Higher Education, so that when we do formulate advice and send it to the minister at, on our own volition, that it is research-based and that it is rigorous in order to influence or inform policy. Deliverables, as far as this is concerned, further research publications, we have a whole range of them. There's one that's regularized, which is called Vital Stats. That gives a highly aggregated picture of performance of the entire higher education system. It's based on the data that we draw out of the HEMAS system. And it's a tremendously useful resource to help our monitoring role in the sector. And the intention also is to have a conference as well for the financial year. And the next one is administration and support, and the main elements here are to ensure that we have the enabling environment for us to do our work and the capacities, the IT system, and also to ensure that we comply with all of the prescripts in terms of the PFMA, and then of course the governance structures which oversee the entire organization, provide the strategic direction, and make the key decisions as far as the quality assurance functions are concerned. I proceed then to slide here, which is 28, gives you a picture of the human capacity at the moment, and I won't go into the details. And we proceed next to the risk management. It gives you an idea of all of the high-level risks that we've identified, and then what the mitigation strategies are for each. And again, there's quite a lot of detail here, which I won't go into in the interest of time. But we can always illuminate any particular ones that you may wish us to. I think that I'll hand over to the CFO to speak to the budgets and financials. You can come here.
Thank you, Chairperson and the CEO and the Chairperson of this Portfolio Committee and members of the Portfolio Committee. Just to indicate before I start with the presentation that, as members know, there's a grant allocation that we normally receive from Department of Higher Education and Training. And the baseline for 2018-19 is 54 million as indicated in the slide before you. The reason why we are reflecting the difference between the loaded budget and requested budget is just to reflect that for us to achieve SDG, to achieve all the intended objectives or strategic objectives as the CEO has presented, actually we'll need about 65 million instead of 54. And I think we have been saying in this house from time again that the baseline that we normally get, or the grants that we normally receive from DHET and National Treasury, covers majority, it goes to the compensation of employees on the total structure of 52 employees, where it was never increased since the establishment of CG. The only increase is about the payments that is made to the employees on an annual basis. So the total cost, which is very critical, is the goods and services budget. We have done our method of budget allocation is activity-based budget, because majority of our process is activity-based. So we cost the activity based on what we wanted to achieve. In terms of what was submitted and consolidated from the other program managers, the submitted total goods and services budget is about 28.8 million. But because of the budget pressures that we had, we only managed to submit about 17.3. And with the, we took as management with a conscious addition that yes, we know that we only have 17. But just to share with the members that during last year, if we recall very well, we came and presented that we were struggling, we had the budget pressures, but then there was a submission or there was an approval that was made late last year. Unfortunately, I'm saying late last year because it was done in December 2017, for us to can be able to do whatever that we intended to do. So the cash, the available cash in terms of CG in hand, was received into our bank account on this in December 2017. Obviously, taking into account that December is a half month and January is a half month, we will not be in a position to spend the total amount of 12.5 which was approved by DHET for us to can spend. And this translates to obviously saying that after we have done our books, there will be a surplus that CHC is going to realize in terms of the cash available. And I can't for sure now indicate how much because, as you know, we are currently busy doing the finalization of the annual financial statements, which will be submitted in May to National Treasury and DHET. And by then, we'll actually know the actual amount that will be reflected as a surplus in terms of our books. The intention of that surplus is to try to make sure that we cover the budget for, as indicated, for goods and services, which in terms of the slides, as you can see before you, is indicated as 11.5, with the hope that whatever that will be left as a retention will be in a position to cover that shortfall. And then the other slide was just trying to show you the breakdown of goods and services in terms of for personnel cost. And what is very critical is this slide, which is explaining how we allocate the compensation of employees to the sub-programs. Basically, it's informed by the number of employees within the structure of a sub-program, based on the level of each employee within the sub-program. And the other thing is just to try to highlight to the members to note the percentage that each sub-program is taking towards the allocation of compensation of employees in total, to see how much does it equate in terms of the budget. As I indicated before, majority of the total compensation of employees takes about 68% based on the grants allocation. So obviously we are left with about 30-something percent to can allocate to core. The challenge that I normally share with the council members and management is that that 30% has to cater for core function and also for support. Support taking into account that support, especially in terms of corporate services and facilities and ICT, there's a lot of maintenance, there's a lot of contracts that are already in place. The risk for us to can say that tap into the contracts is that we are inviting litigations, unnecessarily so, because if you already appointed somebody to do some job for you for 3 years or 5 years, there's no way that in the middle of the contract you can say, I won't pay you the full amount of the contract because of financial constraints. So our budget process is that firstly look at the compensation of employees, then the second point is look at all the fixed contracts and variable costs. The remainder then must go to the core, which is a challenge. And I want to thank the Department of Higher Education and Training because we are working very closely with them. They are aware of the issues. There was a planned meeting between ourselves and the CFO from DHET, which did not materialize, but because of the busy schedule from the CFO. We are so proactive because we tried to give them the picture of saying, looking at the financial background and financial spending, we want them to proactively give us an approval as early in the new financial year to use the cash, not to give us additional budget, to give us the approval to utilize the cash that is in our bank, so that we can be able to achieve the intended APP as highlighted by the chairperson and the CEO. So we hope, because immediately when the approval comes early, the better, then we are able to can achieve whatever that we are intended to do. The other slide, which just narrates the issue of the goods, the allocation of goods and services per program, reflects how much is allocated per program. And I think you can see that administration is getting more compared to other core programs. And the main reason is that, as I indicated, majority of the fixed and variable contracts are within corporate services. That's the reason why their budget is higher than compared to their core programs. And then it results in that shortfall, as I indicated, of 11.5. And I think this slide, which says the notes on goods and services budget, really explain and reflect how much is taken in terms of what is allocated to the total goods and services, which most of them, you can see that administration takes about 58 because of what I said about the fixed and variable cost, and institutional audit 23%, qualification management 17%, and research and monitoring 2%. And I think research and monitoring is because the bulk of the work that is done is a research. I think if colleagues, the members understand well, research is now, the institutional quality assurance is more on peer academics, where we invite people to come and traveling costs, because next time when we come and present, you'll see that the cost drivers for CHE is more on traveling. Why? Because we appoint governance structures, and then automatically it relates to them traveling, and then we have to book them for all the accommodation and the traveling costs. So the expenditure obviously goes up. But for research, because it can be done in-house, there's not much of the people that are appointed there. So there's a reason why the research issue is a little bit lower than compared to all other core programs. And lastly, as I said, we are not just sitting, and because we know that we have challenges, there's a reason why we have a slight say that funding proposal for the budget shortfall, where we are saying, come when we have finalized the financial statements, which will be at the end of May, we hope that whatever that will be reflected there will cover the shortfall. And what is additional to the shortfall is only the two. It might go down to 1 point something, depending on what will be the final surplus as reflected in our books, because the reason why I'm saying it was a preliminary report, I think technically is that currently we are busy doing the provisions and all that. So the final annual financial statements will give a true reflection of the total surplus that we'll be having, which will be audited by the Auditor General of South Africa. In addition to that is about the intention, as the chairperson and the CEO highlighted, the issue of the integrated online system, which will be used by the other core programs. We are estimating about 10 million, which will be done in phases of three. And then the department is aware, because we are having quarterly meetings with the department in terms of how they can assist us in doing that. Just to highlight to the members that we had a meeting with the Department of Higher Education through Dr. Parker, where there was proposal that other projects like core projects, we need to do a submission to them in terms of accreditation and institutional audit, cost them, and they will see how they can assist us in terms of making sure that those projects are funded moving forward. They will see, they don't have funds, but they will see how are they going to do it, to assist us in terms of doing that, so that at least when we come back after August and September to this same house, then we will be in a position to say all the planned activities has been budgeted for and we are hopeful that the budget will be covered. I think the important thing, and which D had also agreed because we showed them the real facts, is that the baseline since the CHU was established was not enough. And I think what is critical is that the structure, the number of people in the structure did not increase. It's the same number since the establishment. So the baseline actually is not enough. And we are not just sitting and saying, because it's not enough, therefore we cannot do anything, but we are reprioritizing as prescribed by PFMA, reprioritize, and try to see what we can do with the little we have. The important thing is that we have a very sound, cordial relationship with the AGSA, where they clearly understand where we come from in terms of not achieving certain targets within the APP, because as you know, performance information is audited by AGSA, and they really support us to say if we have valid reasons why, then there's no reason for them to can give us a very adverse audit opinion. I think that's all I can say. Thank you, Chairperson. Thanks.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I take it there's no additions. Honourable members, over to yourself. Honourable Van der Westhuizen, Mavunda, Kekana, and Boon.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just a short question from my side. It's always wonderful when people anticipate what's going to happen and when they recognize it and when you start planning for it. Now, if you could expand a little bit on your plans about the turnaround time, improving the turnaround time for program accreditation, particularly at the private institutions. And I've been interested in your prediction that you might find a great growth in the demand for you to do that kind of work. Now, when you know that your resources are limited and your workload is going to treble in a specific area, surely you must be looking at completely different approaches of trying to achieve the same. And my impression is that you've already got an established model whereby you utilize people on a part-time basis, where you bring in expertise from outside to assist you. Would you just please share with us your plans to alleviate this? I know you've said you've approached the department and so on, but if you could just perhaps come down a little bit more and tell us what are your plans. How can we and you assure that those out there that would be affected by this, there's a solution and that this anticipated problem will eventually not materialize? Thank you.
You don't have to speak, Honourable Member, but I recognize you. Is there, Honourable Kekana, do you want to say anything? No? Honourable Mavunda, anything?
Thanks, Chair. And again, the same concern I raised with the previous presenters about the gender sensitivity. But Chair, I just want to check with the committee that according to PFMA, are you allowed to budget for deficit? So maybe I did not hear you correctly. I might misheard you. I thought we were talking about something like budgeting for deficit. On page 4, slide 28, you talk about the positions of vacant posts. And then you indicated that there are 8 that are outstanding, which are not filled. But what qualifications are those which are not filled? Because somehow in one of the entities presented that there are many qualified young people in South Africa who are sitting on the on their degrees. But I'm looking at this vacant post as to whether do they not qualify to be recruited, especially that on program 2, is it program 2? Yeah. On program 2, you indicate that one of your objectives is to maintain the database of student records. I'm just thinking aloud to say only those who are enrolled with certain institutions or those who have already graduated. Because I think it will be good that you have the database of those who graduated so that you are able to make a follow-up as to whether are they absorbed by some industries or some other employing institutions. So I think those are the few questions, Chair, I wanted to ask. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Mdunu.
Oh, thank you, Chair. No, thank you for the presentation. I just want to reiterate the question asked by Honourable, my colleague, Mafunda. The one which is on your slide 46, where there is a proposal for a budget shortfall of 12 million, I want to know whether this is allowed by the PFMA. Because I can see even in your conclusions where you are recommending that the portfolio committee to note the APP and a budget allocation with these challenges and the budget for shortfall. I want to know if is this acceptable according to law. The second one, given the fact that the expansion of the mandate has not been accompanied by a review of and consumer rate adjustment in the level of baseline funding to CHE, does this mean that this unfunded mandate will not be implemented? Okay. If so, what will be the risk to the implementation of the articulation policy for the post-school education and training system in South Africa? Thank you.
So from my side, are you saying to us that you are not in a position to provide advice to the minister anymore? And maybe you can tell us what other sort of advice, having dealt with the fee issue and so on, that you have been able to engage with. And then secondly, if you look at the aspects in the National Development Plan, how do you see your role in providing that
platform to make a contribution to the one aspect that talks about we need to find consensus in South Africa as it relates to higher education. I'm not quoting the sentence verbatim, but it speaks to that we need to find consensus. The fact that you are saying you do not have, I mean, if you've raised this issue last year also about your funding needs, can you point out to us what is it that can't happen anymore due to your funding challenges, as you say? And then on some other bigger issues, can you put up a good case for us to say why CHE must still remain in existence? Why can't you merge with the other quality councils? Why must we, besides what the legislation says, just forget about the legislation for a second, why must we have the CHE still? And if you must still be there, why are you not doing anything for the colleges? The answer is not you don't have money. How do you see yourself? How do you see yourself providing that strategic planning stuff, objective stuff, and so on in after fees have been tackled? I want to use my words cautiously here. Tackled. How do you see yourself providing anything to the country that speaks to what are our important agenda items, having dealt with fees in the manner that we have done? And the answer is not the here, Commission. And what do you think the role of the CHE can be in providing that particular narrative to the country on where do we take education to in the country? Do we wait for another something to occur and then we all hurry together and we try and provide some some thought? Or maybe you can tell us, you know, in this APP, in the plans and programs that you have given to us, does it take into consideration those questions that I have asked? I'm asking the question, why must it be a CHE? Don't take it personal. I'm not advocating for any this way or that way. I'm asking the question because I think it's important that we... There's nothing wrong for us to continue to review decisions that we have taken. CEO, Chair, CFO, I leave it up to you who want to answer first.
Chair, probably request that other council members respond to some of the questions first, and then we will follow with some of the technical responses.
Sorry. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I think I want to respond to the issue of the existence of the CHE, because I think that's quite an important question. And the way in which we can respond to it is to say that the the kinds of legacies that the National Development Plan tells us still exist have not yet been dealt with in the past 20 years. And the reason it hasn't been dealt with is that the university, the principle of autonomy, has meant it's very difficult to get inside universities. And so the legacy that is in the NDP and for which we have a mandate in our country is still, it still continues. So for example, the increase in enrollments from 1 million in the next, you know, 10 years to 1.6. That has got huge implications for infrastructure and quality of the kinds of graduates that comes out of the system. So in that sense, the quality component of the CHE continues to remain. And that the aspect of fees must fall is that it's but merely a symptom of a much broader and bigger problem in the education system. It is no accident that while we do have our demographics in terms of access, that our throughput rates are very, very low. And I also want to alert honorable members and honorable chair that the level and the profile of African postgraduates is appalling and in fact is a travesty of justice in our country 24 years later. So these are issues that still provide the space for an entity like the CHE to be even further sustained and further supported in order to redress the legacy. And this has to happen in consort with the NDP. So we have to keep that in mind. The question of consensus that the National Development Plan signals, I think we continue to, the CHE is in a fortunate position being a kind of a middle entity between institutions and the state. And so, for example, the kind of review that has just happened around the LLB, one of the key elements of that review has been articulation and progression between institutions. Now, that is a practical way in which we develop consensus in order for our students to move through the system. So the CHE has a, there are practical ways in which one can give meaning to the notion of consensus and getting together stakeholders, etc. But let me leave it at that, and maybe someone else might want to come in, a colleague. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I wouldn't like to follow up there. I just want to touch on the issue that has been raised by Honorable Mabunda, the issue of the vacant posts and their qualifications and the concern about the unemployed graduates. I think that's a very important... The other... I think that it's a very important point that you raise, but the question of vacancies in most cases, the problem of the graduates that are unemployed, there's a big problem of skills. You have people graduating in wrong areas, and those are most of them form the bulk of the, and the demands of work in certain areas demand certain specific skills, and hence you have a number of graduates who are unemployed because they have graduated in wrong areas. So the vacancies that exist are more related to areas that are more specific in the organization. For example, informatics, the ICT areas, and which are not provided in that grouping. So I think this is an issue that also the the organization is actually working around to try and reorganize the issue of the curriculum. In fact, research has been done in that area to actually review the curriculum in order to make sure that people, and also in line with the NDP, to make sure that young people select relevant courses that are going to be relevant for new types of work, not the conventional and the traditional, because that changes in the work environment. So I think the CHE has those vacancies, but the demand is for specific skills that are not provided by the graduates that are unemployed. So I think that is the issue, Mr. Mavunda.
Thank you, Ambassador. Anything else? Anyone else?
Chair, if I may answer some of the questions. I thought you might have the last word. If I may address firstly the question raised by Honourable van der Westhuizen on the plans, contingency plans to deal with the huge volumes. Yes, very much so. We are looking at quite a novel approach and a different approach with cluster evaluations. We're also looking at, should we secure the funds, which we are making a bid for, is to employ three or four retired academics with experience in the area. So they'll be working full-time to deal with the huge volume. So instead of doing each individual or giving each program to an individual to evaluate and looking for hundreds and hundreds of people, so we'll do it in clusters and streamline the process. And a related question is by Honorable Mabunda, is about the vacancies. One of the reasons why we haven't filled the vacancies is that because the vacancies are not in accreditation, there is actually one or two of them in accreditation, but the others are in monitoring and evaluation and in standards and reviews. So we've redirected the resources in the short term to deal with this bubble. That's why we haven't filled the vacancy weights in the approved structure of the other directorates. So it's on the short term to make those resources available to the accreditation directorate. Now, we also, on the question of how do we deal with the student records, yes, this particular one that we speak to here relates to the private higher education providers. So they are on an annual basis required to submit all of their student data. So we have at any time a picture of how many students at what levels doing what programs. Then also there's graduation data. So once the students graduate, they are obliged legally, in fact, to submit that data so that we maintain an up-to-date database. So what you're requesting is for graduate destination data. That's a different order of data. And it's desirable. It's desirable for the whole system, not just for private, but also for the public. And we've been talking to USAF, for example, about a graduation destination survey. I know that the department has also applied its mind to it. So all of the key players and stakeholders are thinking about it and will possibly collaborate in a project as far as this is concerned. I think the other questions actually should be answered by the CFO before the chairperson. Thank you.
Just to respond to the concern raised by the members about the deficit, I think I did not mention, yes, the reason why we are trying to reflect the budget shortfall is just to give the members an idea. We know and will adhere and we comply with PFMA. Hence our header says that loaded budget. Therefore, that means whatever that has been loaded in terms of the budget is within the baseline. So the main issue was just to reflect what was projected by the programs in terms of the actual amount that they needed so they can be able to do the work. And as I said, and I think it's a very important question to say, which areas in terms of the APP will be affected? Majority of the issues that will be, for example, I'll just make an example with development of standards and reviews. Take into account what the CEO was saying, that is a recurring process which takes about 2 to 36 months. Obviously, that means they will still continue with what they were doing last year to complete that phase in the current, in the next financial year. Therefore, it reduced the number of standards development in that area in terms of what we intended to do. But the issue, the main issue is on accreditation programs where we rely more on submissions, not on us doing the work, but on submissions from the institutions, which is a different case. In terms of research monitoring and advice, it reduced the number of proactive and not the other way advice that we give to the ministers to say, if we intended to do 5, it automatically says that within the little that we have, if we don't get enough funding, that means we'll end up doing 1. But if the minister, there's an agreement between ourselves and the head to say, some of the requests that comes from the minister, especially in terms of advisors, they will fund us for those advice so that we can be able to, so that that particular program called Research Monitoring Advice can be able to fast track and give, because they are mandated to do that kind of a job. So there's no knowing point that we have budgeted for a deficit, because definitely for sure it's going to be an audit finding. So there's no deficit planning for a budget. It's just that we wanted to reflect, so that illustrate, so that when we come back to the committee, we can make reference to what we said in this particular meeting. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I'll attempt to answer some of the questions that you posed. One of which was, what is it that you can't do as a result of the challenges that you have? And one immediate example is we can't do audits for institutions in an accelerated manner to actually get deeper into these many either governance challenges and other related such problems that institutions encounter. We had to rely on funding on a project basis by the department to perform the Zululand audit. We can't, as it is required, be able to arrange conferences and attend, especially international engagements, with institutions in our ilk across the world to keep apace with developments in higher education and training. And those are actually some of the things. In terms of advice, for example, to the minister, we can't have proactive advice, that which the minister asked, and we are also mindful of the fact that the CHE is not everything else that require money to do. It's not like that. But where you need to engage other intellectual inputs and get people into a space where they can engage to advise, we are not able to advise. For example, you will read from time to time that there are all sorts of scandals at institutions, like sex for marks and all those kinds of things, social sexual harassment, all of those things. I mean, it is within our mandate to advise the minister if we can get in there and do what we have to do. But we have to cut our cloth according to our size. And if you go there and it's overwhelming, you're not able to do it because you don't have resources and the expertise to find, because things like that you can't just do. You need to find, you know, trained people to actually counsel you know, even some of the students that go through these things, it's quite traumatic. And many students are afraid to say and come forward. Even within institutions, there are whistleblowing mechanisms and all sorts of things. And so, but then just to advise on those kinds of issues. And I don't want to give a long list of things that we could do that we are not able to do. And yes, I think in terms of whether the CHE could exist or not, for me, it's neither here nor there, as long as we can be able to find a mechanism within which there would be oversight into quality assurance mechanisms across institutions, because we know that sometimes when we propagate independence and autonomy, people can do what they like, and then you have a problem of integrity and recognition of qualifications across our borders, and even employers, and they will start discriminating. But for now, as we say, once a standard is developed, and that's what we do, you either fall in line or you're out. And that is a process that is fully consulted and has integrity. Thank you, Chair.
There's nothing from the department?
Thank you, Chair. I think that we need to acknowledge that the department is very well aware of the challenges that the CHE has. And we have been working very closely with the CHE in terms of identifying specific areas where we could support them. For example, if you think about the quality improvement project, we recognized that the CHE wouldn't have the funding to be able to do that last year. But we also recognized it was a critical quality issue for the system and capacity building for the system. And therefore, we provided a collaborative grant from a teaching development grant to the CHE in order to carry out that work. And we're working very closely with them in terms of identifying funds that we could utilize to assist in carrying out essential work while we deal with the issue of the baseline. I think it's really important to recognize that we know that there are huge challenges in the system, but there is a substantial additional funding coming into the higher education baseline. But we couldn't deal with that without a proper discussion and negotiation with National Treasury, with the CHE, and with USAF, because we know that in the long run, in order to ensure we have an effective accreditation and quality assurance system, is critical for the quality of the higher education sector. So all of these issues we've been working with the CHE on, and we've requested specific project plans for things we know are essential to continue in the system, particularly this issue of the bubble around the HEQS of alignment, so that we are able to ensure that continuity while we deal with the larger issue. So I think we appreciate that. I think the issue of the PFMA, as was explained by the CFO, but perhaps CFO, it could have been presented differently. So it didn't look as if though it was a deficit in that way, because the key issue is about getting approval for the rollover of the funds that are already at the CHE. So I think, from that perspective, we do think that the CHE is an important part of our quality assurance system. They have a major role to play in terms of steering the system. And we need to ensure that they are capacitated to do that effectively, as we as without quality in our institutions, and without ensuring that as we try to improve throughputs, we actually are improving the qualification that a student has, it will be very detrimental to our system. CFO, I don't know if you want to add anything.
One point. Echo the point that our chairperson made about, you know, whether it's a CHE or not, and to say that the issue of how we begin to think of our overall system in the country as moving from an elite system to a mass system to one that's more universal would behove on us as a CHE to look at the overall post-school and education, higher education and training system as a whole. And I think those kinds of conversations would be a kind of challenge for us taking it to the next phase in terms of how we enable access and throughput for our students in the entire post-school education and training system. I just wanted to make that one point. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair.
All right, honourable members, I'm sure you will join me in thanking the CHA for their presentation here today. I think we will deliberate as a committee on yours and the other APPs that we have received today. We might come back to you and ask you more questions on some of the things that you have said, because one of it might be are you able to still stay within your legislative objectives, and are you still in line with your both the objective and your policy, and as it relates also to the National Development Plan. And we'll look at your programs and your finances within that context, and then see within all of that the current phase that we are in, insofar as higher education and training is concerned, and what do we need to do about the trajectory, and what are the high level input that we require into the discourse that will take us to the next phase that we have said we should be in the NDP. We might just be here on the forward word of the NDP still, and I don't think you are outside of that. So when we talk about the NDP, we don't mean the department, we mean all of you, and if there's one that suffer within that chain, then we need to see. So I think that the issues that you have raised, the financing issues, the topics, we'll look at it in that entire context. And then, of course, we'll do what we normally do, make some recommendations to yourself, and if it's necessary to the department and the minister, we will, of course, do that also, and see what do we do with the conversation. We might not ask you to come back only CFO at the end of the year. We might ask you to come back earlier to answer a range of other things, or to engage with you on a range of other things, because we must continue to discuss the qualitative nature of higher education and training in the country, and we must all be worried when people say that the quality of education is going down. Sometimes I don't know down to where or where it came. People are just... But I think we must continue to be concerned about the qualitative nature of higher education and training in our country. I accept you didn't answer the. You jump the college issue. I understand, but I'm sure that you will send an answer after you have thought through it and provide an answer, because you can't not answer a question when we ask you. So some of it that you have tucked, the chairperson and CEO, it's not as automatic as that. You will find an answer and provide us with that. Thank you very much. Honourable members, I trust on that basis there is nothing else from your side. I only, Honourable van der Westhuizen.
Perhaps you can just confirm when and where we will see each other again.
I was coming to that. As we end off our day tomorrow, we will meet in Kudo Chamber on the other side of Parliament. We will start at 9:30 again. We will have the 9 o'clock. We'll start at 9 o'clock, and we will deal first with SACWA, QCTO. And then, honourable members, you would remember when we had oversight to CPUT. You remember we said that we'll ask the council to come to Parliament. DDG of universities. We trust somebody from the department is going to be here tomorrow. We need to just hear from your side also what is happening there. We need your assistance to inform the chair of the council not to do a UniZulu on us, and to make herself available to be at the meeting. She is, by the way, in this building. She can just walk one step, few steps up, and come to the meeting. A letter, honourable member, has been sent to me by the chair of the council that says that she is not available tomorrow. My view is that she has to be available. We can talk about how can we make her available to be there for an hour or half an hour or whatever, but we can't not have the chair of the council doing a UniZulu on us and not wanting to come. I hope you agree with me, honourable members, that we tell the chair of the council to be there. Otherwise, we hand them over to the CHE. Yes, honourable Mavunga.
Last time, Chair, we went there, and it was out of a proposal to say we would like you to come to our area. Then we went there, but she was also not there, you know. The apology that we received was not approved. We did not approve the apology, because you can't convene a meeting and at the same time you do not attend after people have come to your meeting. Then you say you apologize, you are not going to be part of the meeting. So I think we are taken for a ride, and I don't think it's nice, you know, to feel to each other, because these institutions must be accountable to portfolio committee. So it's not whether, unless if she's in hospital, then we can go there, no problem, and sort out. Yes. Yes. Yeah, with the drips and everything. We can go there, because it's long that way.
Chair, just to add,
Again, if we remind ourselves what happened when we went there, it actually, and we pointed out that we feel undermined by the reaction of the council, because first of all, they delegated somebody a secretary who does administration, as it was explained there, to give a presentation, and we refused that he or she was not the appropriate person. And then there was an enthusiastic member of council who wanted to replace the secretary and be given a chance. And when we said, no, we don't think you are fit and proper because you don't have the mandate of the council to talk, he then said council was doing oversight. They said he can come, but he shouldn't open his mouth. He must just open his ears and listen. Now, just the way we treated Chair, I don't think he's taking us serious as council itself. Remember that the units were saying council must be restructured. We were surprised why this recommendation, but we saw for ourselves that though something is fundamentally wrong. So I think we must start looking at our legal recourse and make Chair Abid, if a person is not showing willingness to do her work, it doesn't help us to persist that he must do his work. If he's lost interest for one reason or the other, it is the university, the institution that will suffer if he persists. So I'm just saying we must start looking at our options, because legally speaking, you know, you can take your horse to the river, as it says, but you can't force it to drink. Pull it down, drink. It doesn't happen. People must show willingness and the love for what they are doing. If the interest is no more, then we should look for other options. Maybe between today and tomorrow, if possible, we should get legal advice, especially for legal requests. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. I think the message is loud and clear that the Chairperson must be persuaded to come to the meeting, exactly for all the reasons that we have said the last time, that we caution the Chairperson not to say that she's going to a meeting with a Speaker of Parliament and therefore she can't come, that is not going to work at all. That the Chairperson of the Council must be careful that we don't decide to go to the meeting where she is and have the meeting with her right there. And then how would she like that? Because it's one, from here we just walk down first floor. We walk there and we say we're here to meet with you. So I think that we must explain to the Chair of the Council. She is still the Council Chair. She is in this institution where she knows very much how we deal with people. We wouldn't want to send the hawks after her also. And we must just explain to her that it will be in her interest and the Council interest. We can negotiate the time that she needs to sit, but to use the Speaker's name is just not... It's not happening. It is not an excuse for us. So, we want to ask the department, please assist when you get these people to be on the council. Let us not have these problems that suddenly when they see the heat come, then they go this way and that way and so on. And then they use other people's names while they can't function. We would want to know from the department tomorrow, is that council functioning? It doesn't sound like they are functioning at all. The big, big uproar at the meeting that we were at CPUT is none of the parties want to see the council. They don't want the council. Big issues about the fact that they don't want the council. They're all united. There are many unions there. They're all united with each other on this issue. So maybe the fault isn't with the council, it's maybe the other people, but we don't know because we don't have the opportunity to meet with them. So yes, may we ask any one of you in the room to prevail also from the department side on the council chair and to say that she must come and take the opportunity to to meet with the committee tomorrow and not to not take the opportunity to do that. We will not appreciate that at all. We will not have a situation where somebody sends a letter to us and say, we have decided not to come to your meeting, and then we had a meeting and we have decided to send two people, and we decided not to come because we didn't get any of the submissions from the other parties yet, and that's why we didn't come. So we sent two people just to sit there and hear what the others are saying. How do you function like that as a council who is in a higher education act to send messages like that? CHE, we're bringing you another one that you have to deal with. Because, yes. Ty Parker said as soon as it's their job that you must do, they come with money to you. So, okay. Honourable members, may we thank the CHE very much. May we thank those members of the department that stayed till the end, honourable members, and all the other people that are in the meeting. I think we must bring this meeting to an end, and thank you very much, and we'll see each other 9 o'clock tomorrow. Honourable members, the reason why we're starting 9 o'clock is you would know that we have to do all of those things by lunchtime because there's a sitting of the House. We'll move. Oh, mossing us around. Okay, that's not the case anymore. Any case, we're dealing with that. Then why do we have to start at 9 o'clock? Honourable members, the reason why we're starting 9 o'clock is because there was going to be a sitting. And the sitting is no longer happening. So why don't we just start 9:30? Yeah, this morning people start. Let's just start 9:30 tomorrow. It's not going to happen because of the transport problems. Honourable members, see you at 9:30 tomorrow in the Good Hope Chamber. Thank you very much. The meeting has come to an end. Yeah.